We begin with a very brief roundup of the week's top stories from Physicians First Watch, read by its editor Amy Herman, and then we chat with Joseph Ross about how organic chemistry isn't just for undergrads. And here's the news.
Hi, everyone. Our first story. Oregon officials reported this week that an individual died in July after vaping. It's the second known death amid a national outbreak of vaping-related lung illness. In addition, health officials said they detected an oil derived from vitamin E in many of the marijuana products used by people who've become sick after vaping. Next, two large reviews find that there's no evidence to support using haloperidol or second-generation antipsychotics to prevent or treat delirium in hospitalized adults. An editorialist says, quote, "I believe the findings presented are sufficient to stop this clinical practice." Elsewhere, an antidepressant with a novel mechanism of action improved depression symptoms in just 2 weeks in a placebo-controlled trial. The drug, referred to as SAGE-217, acts on GABA type A. SAGE-217 is in its early days and has not been FDA approved. Next up, a study finds that pescatarians, that is, people who eat fish but not meat, and vegetarians are at lower risk for ischemic heart disease, but vegetarians appear to be at higher risk for stroke. Editorialists note that the stroke risk was only modestly elevated, and this is just one study. Finally, the American Academy of Pediatrics released its vaccine recommendations for the upcoming flu season. Of note, the group is back to recommending both the live attenuated vaccine, that is, the nasal spray, and the more traditional inactivated flu vaccine. And that's it for this week. Stick around for Joe Elia's latest clinical conversation.
And you thought all you needed to remember from organic chem class was how to draw a benzene ring. Remember racemic mixtures? Think of them as pairs of gloves, all of the same color and style, thrown into a big vat. They are mirror images of each other, but you can't put a right-hand glove on your left hand. Or enantiomeric mixtures. Think all left-hand or all right-hand gloves in the vat. Well, some drugs have mirror images and are released as racemic mixtures. Others, well, we'll let Dr. Joseph Ross explain. He's the senior author on a recent letter in the Annals of Internal Medicine. He's also a professor of medicine and public health at Yale, where, in addition, he's a member of the Center for Outcomes Research and Evaluation. Welcome to Clinical Conversations, Dr. Ross.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
So I hate to go on and on about this, about, you know, left-hand gloves and right-hand gloves, and I'm sure most of our listeners are very well acquainted with organic chemistry and these things, but I had to take it twice. So some single enantiomer versions of drugs are better than racemic mixtures. Is that fair, or is there a general rule?
Well, I don't think they're better would be, ever be the term I would use, because I don't know that they're better or not, although there's, I suppose, the possibility that they might be. Mm-hmm. My guess is that any listener to this podcast probably knows more about organic chemistry than I do. we became interested in this issue because it's a strategy that can be used by pharmaceutical companies when they have a product on the market that's reaching the end of its patent life, in the sense where it's, you know, it soon will be open to generic competition. So there are drugs that have been marketed that are, you know, 50-50 racemic versions, the gloves that you described, both right and left-handed mixed up. And what a company will do is bring to market a right-hand or left-hand only version of the drug. They, you know, they'll claim that this new drug may have benefits or may have better safety outcomes for patients. But what we know from the literature reviews and from the studies of drug when these drugs do come to market is there's infrequently or rarely any known benefit or safety benefit, you know, safety benefits from using these drugs as opposed to the older version.
There's albuterol is an example. About 10 years ago, Journal Watch covered a piece of research that looked at using an enantiomer of albuterol known as levobuterol. And they found in a small study, it was about 80 kids with asthma in an emergency room. They found that if they gave the enantiomer in half the dose of the racemic mixture. There was no treatment difference. There were no differences in the rate of complications, because one of the enantiomers allegedly was the bad enantiomer that yeah. actually might make things worse.
It's good just to even hear that there was that study, because these drugs are rarely studied head to head. Even to secure FDA approval, they don't require head to head studies demonstrating that one is better than the other, for sure. So most of the time, clinicians are left in, you know, making a decision about two drugs. As far as we know, they have equal effectiveness, equal safety. But one's available as a branded drug and it's expensive, and the other is available as a generic and it's very inexpensive. And so if both are available and can be prescribed, there's really no value in prescribing the branded drug, which is why we did this study.
Yes, that was the point. The point wasn't to review organic chemistry for me, but it was to look at the costs of doing some of these things. And so there's a big difference in Medicare spending between the newer drugs, I'm sorry, which get all the advertising, and the generic drugs, which don't get so much advertising. Well, you estimated over a six-year period, I think, 2011 to 2017, that there was a roughly $18 billion savings that could be realized if clinicians had used all racemic mixtures of 12 drugs that you list in the table. Is that right?
Yeah. So what we did is we looked at all of the payers that we were aware of you know, a racemic version that was still on the market, and a single enantiomer version that was also on the market. In almost all cases, the single enantiomer version was newer and more expensive. And we looked to see, well, what could Medicare have saved if they had substituted the cheaper version for the more expensive branded version, which, as you say, is more frequently prescribed because it's advertised more readily and whatnot. So it's the name that physicians are aware of when they're writing the prescriptions. And what we saw is that Medicare itself could have saved, you know, on the order of like $17 billion, while the beneficiaries would have saved another, you know, $1.5 billion or so in reduced out-of-pocket spending. So it's not just, you know, that sort of $18 billion figure is not just how much the agency would have saved as, you know, as a national health program, but it also includes the amount that the beneficiaries who are paying out of pocket for these more expensive drugs would have saved.
And you made some assumptions about that. One of them was you assumed that everyone would be getting the generic form, the racemic, as you call it. I call it racemic, you call it racemic, but it's still the same molecule.
Yes. someone can call in and tell us how to pronounce it.
Okay, all right. In any event, you said that you assumed, rather, that everyone was using the racemic versions, but in some instances, you said that there could be patient considerations at play, and it wouldn't be a rule across the board.
Yeah. So for a study like this, we assumed that the generic racemic version could have been substituted for the single enantiomer in all cases. And that this, of course, you know, it's never going to be 100%. Maybe there's some particular reason. Maybe there maybe some patients do respond better to one version versus the other. But on a population level, we know that there aren't differences between the two drugs and their effectiveness and safety. But I would say actually that the bigger assumption that we had to make relates to the world of rebates, which not everybody will be aware of, which is that, you know, there's all sorts of funny business that happens in order to get a drug on the formulary. We looked at actual Medicare spending, but it's possible that the rebates that were offered to Medicare for keeping these listed on formularies were sizable. In the sense, like, in order to cover this more expensive branded drug, you know, Medicare may have gotten a lot back in rebates. We estimated a 26% rebate on these 12 drugs. So we took that into account and still found, you know, billions in excess spending. Some people have criticized our work and said, well, you know, maybe it was 50%, maybe it was 80%. What I feel very confident about is that the rebate did not equal the total difference in the cost between the two drugs. So there was certainly some wasted spending by, you know, covering these drugs and allowing them to be prescribed to patients at the expense of the generic version.
Yeah, it may well be that your 26% number was too high, and
That's quite possible too.
You know, and I don't know that drug companies are prone to leaving money on the table, as they say in business school. You haven't heard from any drug companies, have you?
No one's said anything about this study.
Okay, just others. And what about your colleagues? Have any of your colleagues stopped you and said, "Gee, you know, I wasn't aware of this."
Well, I haven't had a direct conversation about this article, but I have frequently heard that physicians are unaware of the costs and cost implications of the drugs they prescribe, right? It's very difficult to know at the point, I'm sure all the listeners who are aware of this, it's hard to know how much a drug costs, right? You make a prescription, you're seeing a lot of, you know, you're writing a prescription, you have a lot of patients to see, you're moving quickly. Often you hear in the echoes of your mind, right, the brand name version. And that's what you write. A lot of times we assume that the generic will be substituted, but in this case, they're not the same molecule, right? So you may write, New Vigil, right, in your head, right, and say, okay, well, I know the generic's going to get it prescribed instead. But actually, you know, the generic version of the racemic, right, is not the exact same molecule as New Vigil. And so it can't be substituted. Yeah. So it just means we've got to be a little bit more careful as physicians and attentive to this when we're prescribing these drugs.
So what would you like to see happen as a result of your letter?
Well, so I'm of the mind that, you know, physicians are busy enough as is, and it's unfair to ask them to take on yet another task in the office. I think automatic generic substitution is really the way we've achieved great savings in our healthcare system with respect to prescription drugs. When there's adequate competition, generics cost, you know, a tenth as much as a branded product, and they achieve up to 90% penetration. Once they're on the market, right? It automatically, everyone moves. They use the generic, and that's good for everybody. But that is not a solution to this problem. But that type of systematic solution is what we need. So we need formularies to say there really is no value to this drug versus the other, even though, you know, we may be getting a nice sort of kickback of sorts by getting a big rebate. We still think that the priority should be coverage for the generics and make it difficult to prescribe these branded drugs. That's not impossible to prescribe, because as we talked about before, some patients may benefit from them or respond better to them. But on the whole, on the population, for the broader population, just the generic should be made available.
And when, as far as the FDA goes, when they are evaluating a drug to allow it to go to market, would you like to see them, especially when there's a single enantiomer proposed to them, would you like to see them say, okay, so I need proof now that the racemic version, is the same as the enantiomer?
Yeah, well, I would like to see that, but I think that the FDA would argue that it's not within their oversight abilities to require a comparison to show that it's better than an already existing drug. The FDA is bound by law, and the law is that the drug has to be, you know, safe and effective. It doesn't have to be safer or more effective than other existing treatments that are available on the market. So that's why this becomes a game of sorts for companies, right? They, in the rare instances where they can bring a single enantiomer version to market, you know, it just allows them to extend the patent life and the market profitability of that original discovery from way back when.
So it's a game that we all get to play, you know, patients, clinicians, drug companies, attorneys, the FDA. Yeah. Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Ross, for talking about this interesting letter with me today.
Joe, it was my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me to talk about it.
That was our 232nd clinical conversation. The whole searchable collection is available free at podcasts.jwatch.org. Let us know how we can improve these chats. Email me, jelia@nejm.org. We come to you from NEJM Journal Watch. The executive producer is Kristen Kelly. I'm Joe Elia. Thank you for listening.